and welcome to the Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. The key respect in which humanity's self-management has to improve is, to put it bluntly, by growing up. It is an existential matter. Those are the words of my guest today, the eminent philosopher, author, and academic whose latest book is framed by a question that might seem unpressing and esoteric, but turns out to be precisely the reverse, urgent and vital. And that question is, who owns the moon? Welcome to the Bunker, Professor A.C. Grayling.
Thank you, Alex. Great pleasure to be with you.
Anthony, it may seem glib to begin with that central question, but I must, because in many ways the book is about the problems created by the answer. So who owns the moon?
Nobody does, which means everybody does. And that's part of the nub of this problem. If we all own it, then we all have an interest in it, and we should therefore also all have a say in it. And very, very few people are having a say in it.
In order to glean what that might be a problem, you draw several historical parallels, not as directly transplantable to this situation, but more as behavioral markers. What do we tend to do when there's a free-for-all, basically?
Well, I mean, after the Second World War, the United Nations, having come into existence on the back of all the horrors of the 1930s and 40s, decided that really the world's got to get together. It's got to think rationally about how it organizes the fact that the globe is a globe, and we're, you know, brushing up against one another all the time and scratching one another all the time. So efforts have been made. The very first of them, not by the UN, in fact, but by a group of countries who had an interest in the Antarctic, to try to come up with a treaty that would preserve the Antarctic and keep it just for peaceful purposes, scientific research, and the rest. Now, in fact, that treaty, which was signed in 1961, was really a Cold War treaty. It was really the US and USSR who wanted to try to park any problem they could park that might be an unexpected trigger for problems. I mean, there they were in the Arctic, practically bordering one another, and there were, you know, serious enough problems in the Arctic. But they wanted to make sure that, especially the US, because all the sovereignty claimants of the Antarctic were, in fact, allies in NATO. Mm. So they wanted to be sure there wouldn't be a problem. Came up with a treaty, no weapons, no nuclear testing. And by the way, the US had thought of testing nuclear weapons in the Antarctic, which just shows you, you know. But anyway, going to be no military installations, just science, just peace. And that treaty is held up as a model of what an international treaty should be like. It's regarded as one of the most successful, and it is fraying at the edges. And I mention it because even if we were able to get a pretty decent set of frameworks for what happens out there in space, now that the big space race is really taking off, you know, we would have this problem that treaties are only abided to by the parties to them while it's in their interests. But the need to get people to agree about how to behave and now really applies to space, because this Wild West, this gold rush phenomenon is going to happen in the next 5, 10, 20 years.
And the Antarctic Treaty has actually held up really well, in contrast to, say, current resistance to regulation of deep sea exploration, which is another parallel that you draw from. Why is that, do you think?
Well, in part, of course, it's because of the hostile environment, I suppose. In part also because there are powerful environmental lobbies that really don't want the Antarctic messed with too much. But unfortunately, if you dig into the weeds of the Antarctic, if you dig into the snow there a little bit, you find out actually that there is a bit of a problem. And the problem is there are some bad faith actors who are involved. So back in 1982, China was admitted to the Antarctic Treaty Organization. 1985, it built its first research station there, the Long Wall Station. It now has five. And it has breached already the terms of the treaty by building installations without the consent of other treaty parties. That's number one. Number two, its stations there really do have military uses, in that they have the Beidou satellite tracking system, which is vital to military surveillance and communications. But also, they've done a really sneaky thing, which is that on the basis of a lot of the geological work they've done, the exploration they've done around their stations, they've said that they want the area around their stations to be regarded as a special interest zone for China, which is just a weasel way of saying sovereignty.
Yeah.
They're laying claim to part of the Antarctic in breach of the treaty. Now, this is going to happen on the moon. It's going to happen on the moon because once installations are put up there, the guys who do it don't want anybody else nearby. I mean, if somebody puts a, tries to land a module near your station, it's going to sandblast it. It's going to knock it over. It's going to interrupt its electronics. And you've spent billions of dollars putting it up there. And so you're going to say, we want a zone that's ours. And this begins to look like sovereignty claims, boundaries, borders, and so on the moon. And as you know, those things are very fruitful sources of conflict.
The other area I wanted to zero in is the almost Star Trek sounding UN Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Can you give my listeners the outline of what that is and what it contains?
Sure. So that like the Antarctic Treaty, but this one is a UN treaty, that was also prompted by the US-USSR wanting to park possible sources of conflict. I mentioned that the US had temporarily considered testing nuclear weapons in the Antarctic. Well, the fear was that nuclear weapons might be tested on the moon, or that in time to come, there might be military bases and nuclear installations on the moon. And so what the US and USSR wanted to do is they got the UN to get everybody together and say, let's have a treaty which says no nuclear weapons, no testing, no military bases, but otherwise to acknowledge that the moon is a terra nullius. That's a technical term meaning it's anybody's. If you can get there, you can do what you like there. And this, in effect, means that what's happening now, and don't forget, and we'll come back to this point because it's a really important point, that the people, the major players on the moon at the moment are the Japanese, Chinese, the Indians, the Russians just about to get back in the game now too. Those are state actors. But the really big actors with the big money are in the US. And NASA has itself given up as an agency that develops and flies to the moon and so on. What it's doing is it's commissioning private companies, entrepreneurs, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, these people. And they're the people who are putting in these vast sums of money in the very rational expectation of huge profits, because there are resources on the moon which are very valuable. So, you know, the remark, who owns the moon owns the future, is really true, because as humanity fans out into space and over the course of this century and the next, you know, settlements and colonies and what have you are put up there, it's not science fiction any longer, any of this stuff. How that works is going to be shaped by what's happening now. So if the future of space is being determined by Elon Musk and, you know, a few other entrepreneurs and by the Chinese and so on, it doesn't look great. I mean, it doesn't look like the UN in space. It doesn't look like enlightenment values and human rights and so on. So, you know, it is a real worry, this one. So the 1967 treaty, this was really, as I say, pushed by the US and USSR. It's very minimal. And in declaring the moon a kind of no man's land, it has really provided us with nothing that would restrain activity there, other than military activity. And that is the only thing at the moment which is... by the way, I mean, the UN also said, as it always does, and I'm a huge admirer of the UN, I wish it really could work, you know, but it said, let's keep the moon for peaceful progress, for cooperation and the rest. But these aspirations are in every single treaty. And the minute that money gets into the picture, profits and you know, gotta be first and my rocket is bigger than yours and all the other considerations, that kind of thing goes out of the window. So the treaty is not fit for purpose. We need a better one.
But there is a philosophical difference in how the two are treated, the Antarctic as opposed to outer space, right? One is treated as a sort of common good. The other one is treated as, I think you describe it, as a resource domain.
Exactly.
Why do you think that difference in philosophical approach? Right? When they sat down to draft the treaty in 67, why didn't they naturally go to the Antarctic Treaty of 61 as a sort of model for this thing that belongs to all of us?
penguins mainly, I suppose. I mean, in the sense that the Antarctic has life on it.
Yeah.
And around it.
And visible.
Yeah, exactly. So, and in fact, I mean, one of the problems of the Antarctic Treaty is that it only applies to the continent and not to the Southern Ocean around the continent, which is now being devastated by overfishing. And the Antarctic Treaty Organization has tried desperately to get some protection for the fisheries around there and have failed, which is, again, you know, another bad sign. But the thing is, no penguins on the moon, you know, no seals, no all the rest of it. No life as far as we know. And therefore, some of the considerations that played into thinking about the environment really just don't apply. When it comes to the moon is a, you know, people think of it as a barren rock, although we now know it's a rock full of valuable other rocks. And indeed, the most valuable thing about the moon, the two most valuable things perhaps are, one is water ice. So in the South Pole, there's loads of it. There's probably loads of it in the craters as well. Water ice can be used to make rocket fuel because you can separate the hydrogen and oxygen. You can make rocket fuel. And so for further activity, not just between the moon and Earth backwards and forwards, but also for further exploration to Mars, for mining asteroids. I mean, that's something which is in the sites now. So that's very valuable. But the other thing is helium-3. The surface of the moon is covered in what's called regolith, which is sort of rubble and dust, which lies over the surface of the moon everywhere. And if you heat up regolith, you can capture helium-3. Now, a ton of helium-3 is worth $4 billion. That's about $2,000 a liter. Mm-hmm. You can see why the people who want to get to the moon and harvest this stuff are looking at huge profits. Because helium-3, in combination with deuterium, can be used for nuclear fusion. The engineering problems about nuclear fusion are just now being overcome. And when they are overcome, this is a limitless supply of clean energy, which, of course, is desperately needed on Earth. But it means that the commercial value of this is huge. And it's one of the big drivers for why you're now seeing this scramble. I mean, over the last couple of years, you've seen more and more attempts at lunar landings, and some of them have been successful. People are working very hard on the tech part of this and on the engineering part of it. And they know that it's all possible once they get it right. It's just a practical matter for them now. And so there is going to be, you know, settlement on the moon, and not just robots, not just mechanized settlements, but also people. So this is really happening. And the 1967 treaty is inadequate for it.
You mentioned the sort of current hostility, I think, to international institutions like the UN or the EU or NATO. And I think it's fair to say that you're a fan, not necessarily of every aspect of their operation, but of the scale and ambition of their sort of overarching mission. There is a school of thought that such lofty objectives can only arise out of the trauma of war. And as generational memory fades, there is nothing to be done to keep humanity from making the same mistakes in order to learn from them. But you're a bit more optimistic, I think.
Well, great philosophical answer coming up there. Yes and no. mean, because you see, it's not only war that drives things. It most certainly does. If you think about the fact that in 1939, the Royal Air Force was still flying some biplanes, you know, Gloucester Gladiators and so on. And by the end of the war, they had the Whittle jet fighter. But even before the end of the war, in 1944, there were guided missiles being used, you know, the V-2 rockets. And then in 1945, there were atom bombs. So, I mean, when you look at the difference between 1939 and 1945, the world had just raced forward technologically, military technology, of course. So times of urgency and emergency do that. But look back a bit further. Look back to the beginning of globalization in the 15th century. This is when the Portuguese started to try to find a passage to the Far East in order to undercut the spice trade that was coming through the Arabian countries. And that was a tremendous driver of marine technology, navigation, and discovery, quote unquote. You know, must have been a big surprise to the people in the Americas to be discovered at last.
Yes.
But anyway, you know, all that. And in fact, it's in particular the Americas, South and North, their so-called discovery and their exploitation of their resources, which has driven the massive increase in wealth in the world ever since then. So there, you see, there are two things. There's war and there's profit. And at the moment, when it comes to the moon, it's a mixture of both. Profit is in the driving seat a bit. But another thing people don't realize about what's happening in space is, if you look at the orbital zone around the planet, our planet, with the satellites and the, in constellations of satellites doing geopositioning and surveillance and communications and everything, this has already been assigned the status of what the American Space Force calls a warfighting zone.
Hmm.
Perhaps people do know that in the Trump presidency, a fourth arm of the United States military forces was put into operation. This is the Space Force. The troops in it are called Guardians. I mean, really. And their uniforms are straight out of Marvel Comics. You can't make it up. I mean, you go on the internet and have a look at this and you're just bewildered by it. But anyway, the manual of the Space Force, which is available online, you get a PDF easily. It begins by saying space is a warfighting zone. And already anti-satellite weapons have been developed, laser weapons, techniques for hacking and disrupting satellite communications and electronics. I mean, all this is in play for the very obvious reason that if your country or private entities in your country are doing this stuff out there in space, you want to be able to protect them and defend them. So you've got to have assets ready to be able to do that. And the result, of course, is that everybody arms themselves to the teeth. So if I go back to my example earlier about somebody setting up a base on the moon, starting to harvest helium and water ice, and then somebody else comes along, because after all, geology doesn't behave in the way that we wish it would. So not everything is going to be everywhere. So there'll be places on the moon that everybody wants to get to. And if they're all, barging one another with sharp elbows and the rivalry really heats up, it's almost inevitable that there will be conflict. And, we're already ready for the conflict in a way with this business about a space force and so on. So it doesn't look good, really.
Does the progress made in sort of international environmental agreements maybe point to an alternative model? Yes, it's slow. Yes, it's frustrating. But do we need essentially a regular outer space equivalent of COP where small wins are banked and we work towards more progress? Because it seems to me that part of the problem here is wanting the world to come together as one and sign one massive, all-encompassing treaty, which in the current environment, it just doesn't seem realistic.
It certainly doesn't feel realistic. You're dead right. I mean, the current environment is kind of the last time in history where you would want to be trying to do this. I agree. Well, look at the United Nations efforts to get a convention on the law of the sea. They've been working on that for decades. I mean, ever since the late 1950s. And big players, major players, like the US, for example, won't sign up to it because they don't want to be limited or to have their companies limited in what they can do, again, in the search for returns on their investment. So in the case of COP and the law of the sea, you've got real environmental considerations. And that's a forceful aspect of all this. Indeed, it's about the environment. It's about the health of the planet and humanity on it and so on. And those things don't apply in space. And therefore, some of the restraints, some of the appeals to conscience simply don't work when it comes to space. Therefore, the key thing is to alert people to the risk, the great risk of conflict out there rebounding on Earth. Because here you need to go to history. You need to go and look at the gold rush phenomena, the scramble for Africa, the fact that the very best of our treaties, like the Antarctic Treaty, don't completely hack it. You've really got to go and look at the precedents. And you've got to say, there's got to be a huge amount of benefit from going to the moon and going out into space. Masses. There's going to be a lot of technological advances we can't even imagine yet. There's going to be a lot of resources out there. Better to mine on the moon than on Earth. All that stuff is good. But you've got to look at the possible worst case scenario. And that is that in the usual Wild West situation, which is what the moon is in, it's all six guns, eventually, because people do fall out.
Yeah, indeed, the opening of the the Northwest Sea Passage in the Arctic is already causing quite a lot of ructions.
Yeah.
Now, just to round the conversation, if I want to move to slightly, I guess, bigger things, the subtitle to your book is In Defense of Humanity's Common Interest in Space. Is part of the problem here that exploration and exploitation has in recent decades, as you pointed out, been largely left to private enterprise, which is de facto amoral and obsessed with light or no regulation?
That is exactly the point. And as I said earlier, if you do leave this up to entrepreneurs, private individuals, extremely wealthy individuals, private companies, then the groundwork for how things work out in space, you know, how people in space live and under what conditions, it's not going to be the UN Human Rights Convention, it's going to be your employment contract. You're going to be not a citizen of anywhere, you're going to be an employee of a private company interested in profit.
Yeah.
And that's going to shape how things develop for quite a long time. You know, there is a kind of tragic element to this, which is that over the last couple of decades, politics in the West, in so-called West, has been moving rightwards and rightwards and rightwards. Okay, so now we're beginning to see with the Trump phenomenon and the Tories and everything else, we're seeing where it's getting us. And the trouble with that is that one of the public policy imperatives of politics on the right is low taxation. So, I mean, it's not just that we lose our public services and all that stuff, but also that the state itself shrinks. This is why NASA is not building moon landers and instead it's commissioning. It's because there's just not enough, you know, tax money available for the United States of America.
Voters wouldn't wear the expense.
Exactly. So when the state shrinks, you get these incredibly wealthy entrepreneurial characters stepping in. And then it's them who decide how things are going to work out there and not the government, in agreement with others. So you'll have noticed that the US has set up these things called the Artemis Accords. And there are about 36 countries now, Canada, the UK, Australia, Brazil, France, quite a lot of countries have signed up for this. And this looks terrific because the agreement in the Artemis Accords looks like what the United Nations should be putting in place now. But in fact, it's a kind of disguise in a way. It's preempting the UN from doing anything about it because the US will say, oh, no, we don't want to sign up to another UN treaty because we've got our own accords, A. B, it's in order to get, you know, extra investors, junior partner investors into the enterprise on the US front because the US tech bros will be doing all the work, but the money will be coming in from other countries. And also, I mean, really, really worryingly, China has linked up with Russia to make a kind of Sino-Russian axis, which is parallel to the Artemis Accords. China is the big brother in this because Russia is, you know, hasn't got the technology and the money that China has anymore. And also, Russia has been out of the space game for quite a long time. It just got back in this last year or two. But this is just a reprise of the Cold War. It's just East-West all over again, isn't it? Yes. Artemis is US.
It's the equivalent of the Warsaw Pact. We're seeing its shape, yeah.
Yeah. So you can see that the whole thing begins to smell, you know, much less pleasant when you dig into it.
Yes. I mean, indeed, while I was reading the book, there's almost a quasi-religious parallel there, almost like Catholics, businesses are promised that in exchange for regulation here on earth, this unregulated heaven is being dangled in front of them. Don't worry, you can make all your money there. So I want to finish on a difficult question. Is what is needed actually a new economic consensus? When we're talking about who owns the moon, are we dancing around the fringes of... We seem to have reached an understanding that the invisible hand can be cruel and selfish and that free markets often get it very wrong. And that hasn't percolated to policy. Can there be an acceptance of common good or community property in space while 80% of this planet dwells in poverty?
Well, you make an excellent point. I mean, that is the burning question. And in many ways, you know, the real solution, I mean, I talk about trying to get a really robust, enforceable treaty, a space court set up so that disputes can be resolved and all that kind of thing. But, again, with my sort of newfound realism about international treaties, the real solution is the one that you've pointed at there, which is that we've got to have a big shift of mindset about what really matters and how we behave ourselves. Because if we ask ourselves the question, is the profit motive really the right engine for humanity's future? I mean, out there in space or anywhere for that matter. And all we have to do is just look at the precedents, look at the past, look at the world today and see how incredibly, messed up it is as a result of that. The environment, the incredible injustice and inequality in the world, the way that when the money considerations are almost the only driver, you get a country like ours really starting to stagger along and everything falling to pieces. We really do have to have a different mindset. So you hit the button on the head there. So let's do it, Alex. That's where we've got to go.
Professor A.C. Grayling, thank you so much for your clarity.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Who Owns the Moon in Defense of Humanity's Common Interest in Space is out now, and you can buy Professor Grayling's important book through our affiliate bookshop link in the show notes. You'll help fund The Bunker by earning us a small commission and help support independent bookshops too. These conversations that I know you enjoy because you're kind enough to tell me cost money to make, so please consider supporting us from as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. I leave you with the words of Oscar Wilde today from the mouth of Salome. How good to see the moon. She's like a little piece of money, cold and chaste. I'm sure she's a virgin. She has a virgin's beauty. She has never defiled herself. She has never abandoned herself to men. This is Alexandreou in the Bunker saying over and out.
The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreou. The producer was Eliza Davis-Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.